So Hebrews chapter 7, verse 18 through 28. And this is a section of verses where we're still covering the overall topic of how Christ is a better high priest, a more superior high priest than the Levitical priesthood. And this passage follows a passage that we've studied a little bit recently about how Jesus was a priest after the order of Melchizedek. And so we'll talk a little bit about that again, but not, I mean, just we'll just touch on it because I know we've talked about it before. So let's just start by reading verse 18 through the end of the chapter. For on the one hand, there is an annulling of the former commandment because of its weakness and unprofitableness, for the law made nothing perfect. On the other hand, there is the bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God. And inasmuch as he was not made priest without an oath, for they have become priests without an oath, but he with an oath, by him who said to him, "The Lord has sworn and will not relent, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek." By so much more, Jesus had become a surety of a better covenant. Also, there were many priests because they were prevented by death from continuing. But he, because he continued forever, has an unchangeable priesthood. Therefore, he is also able to save to the uttermost those who come by God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. For such a high priest was fitting for us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and has become higher than the heavens, who does not need daily, as those high priests, to offer up sacrifices first for his own sins and then for the people's. But this he did once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints as high priests men who have weakness, but the word of oath, which came after the law, appoints the Son, who has been perfected forever. All right. So this passage is really the culmination of the question that begins in verse 11. And that question is, therefore, if perfection were through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there for another priest should arise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be called according to the order of Aaron? So the writer of Hebrews asked this question in verse 11. If the Levitical priesthood was perfect, why would we need some other priesthood? Why would there need to be a high priest that would arise from this other order, this order of Melchizedek? And so really from that point on through the rest of the chapter, it talks about, it answers that question. So in verse 18 and 19, it's really a conclusion of that first section. But here we find that there are three things said about the law in this passage. So in those two verses there, what are the three things that are said about the old law? Sort of in a negative way.
The law didn't make anything perfect.
All right, so that's one. It didn't make anything perfect.
It was weak and unprofitable.
And those are the other two. It was weak and unprofitable. So let's just look just a minute at that. How was the law, the old law, the covenant with the Jews, how was it weak? Or what made it weak?
Could never completely take away sin.
Okay. We're going to address that. I think we're going to address that when we talk about how it was imperfect or didn't make anything perfect. But yes, that... And in some way, there's some overlap in these. Jason?
It was physical rather than spiritual.
Yeah.
They had to physically clean their bodies. They had to use physical blood. They had to... Everything was physical. The elements were physical. The candlestick, the table of showbread, they were all physical. And that's one thing that Jesus said in John chapter 4, that God is a spirit, and those that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth.
Right.
And now that we have spiritual blood, spiritual cleanliness, spiritual holiness, We don't need the physical anymore.
Okay. James?
It was conducted by mortal men, by priests, and they had to ask for forgiveness of their sins before they could help anyone else.
Yeah, we're going to get to that towards the end of class. I think Jason's on the right track there, that the reason the law is weak because the law was a physical law. And this seems to be the same kind of thing that Paul talks about in Romans, the 8th chapter, verses 2 through 4. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has made me free from the law of sin and death. For what the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh, God did by sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh on account of sin. He condemned sin in the flesh that the righteous requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. So Paul makes it clear here in Romans 8 that the reason the law was weak is that it was weak through the flesh. Since the new law is not a physical law in the same way that the old law was a physical law, the new law is therefore strong and better. And this seems to be the point that the author of Hebrews is making in chapter 8, verses 7 through 13. I think Mike is going to talk about that next week, so we're not going to address that. But there is some follow-up to this idea of the law being weak. So let's look at the law being unprofitable. So how is the law, the Old Covenant, how is it unprofitable? So we've kind of already addressed that the law was unprofitable in the sense that it didn't make things perfect, but I don't think that's what's meant here. Why is the law unprofitable?
It didn't allow for growth. There wasn't any spiritual growth.
Okay.
It limited who could come to God.
Okay. Paul?
By its definition, you don't gain anything from it. The old law didn't offer salvation.
Okay. I think these are all good answers. Jason?
Well, one of the things we're learning about on Wednesday night right now, too, it bound everything to, again, to physical acts. Right now we're learning about people saying that you have to be circumcised or you have to be a Jew.
Okay.
So that was limiting.
Okay. It may be that I'm just wrong here. Maybe my brain thinks differently than everyone else. I took a little bit of a different approach to this. In Romans chapter 7, verse 5 and 6. For when we were in the flesh, the sinful passions which were aroused by the law were at work in our members to bear fruit to death. But now we have been delivered from the law, having died to what we were held by, so that we should serve in newness of spirit and not in the oldness of the letter. This is a really interesting passage because look at what it says there in verse 5 about the law. For when we were in the flesh, the sinful passions which were aroused by the law. That's a really strange way to say that, because on the surface, and I think that's how we're supposed to take this, in some way, sin, or as it said here, sinful passion, was brought about by the law. Well, how is that? Well, Hebrews chapter 7 talks about that a little bit. Hebrews 7, verses 7 through 11. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law. For I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, you shall not covet. Verse 8. But sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil desire. For apart from the law, sin was dead. I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. The commandment, which was to bring life, I found to bring death, for sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and it killed me. So, when I think about the law being unprofitable, this is sort of the path that my brain goes down, that the law was unprofitable because the law highlighted sin. And maybe in some ways it seems like the writer of Hebrews is trying to say there in Hebrews chapter 7 that the law created this, we might call it a forbidden fruit mentality towards sin. So, in other words, you start wanting the thing that you're told that you can't have. So the law, the old law, wasn't just ordinances about what must be done, like things like sacrifice and feasts. But the law was also about what you can't do, right? Things like you can't covet. That's the example, thou shalt not covet, right? That's the example that's made there in Hebrews. So it seems like to me that in this way is the way the law was unprofitable, because the law then exposed sin and in some ways created this idea of a forbidden fruit. Mike?
In kind of an example there, I think that, you know, human beings are naturally curious. You know, you take, kind of like what you said a minute ago, you take a small kid or maybe a younger kid, and you say, well, you can't do this. Well, what are they going to do? That's exactly what they want to do. And I guess it goes all the way back to Eve.
Sure it does.
You know, you can't eat this fruit, Eve. And all she needed was a little urging, you know, from Satan, and a little lie mixed with the truth to do that thing that she'd been told not to do. Of course, Adam did it too.
And it's a little bit of a generalization, but there's something there that the old law was a law of prohibitions, and then the new law at least is less about that. It's more, the new law is about what you should be doing. Jason?
Yeah, I was just going to say, along with what Mike was saying, a lot of people that I've worked with in affair recovery, one of the things that they've told me is that part of what makes the affair something that they engage in is the forbiddenness of it, the quote-unquote excitement of it, the, you know, keeping things quiet and in the dark.
Yeah, and you know, that's the same for any sin, isn't it? So is the new law profitable? Well, I think the answer to that's yes, right? Think about 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17. All scripture is given by inspiration of God and is what? Profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work. Now, of course, this passage is not exclusively talking about the new covenant, the New Testament, right? It's inclusive of both the Old Testament and the New Testament. But you get the idea that there is profitableness in the Bible. All right, let's look at this last thing, which was the first that was mentioned, that the old law made nothing perfect. Now, actually, this is the premise of this whole section of the chapter, right? It starts with verse 11, where we're just flat out told, if perfection were through the Levitical priesthood, and then it goes on. Well, the same thing applies to the old covenant. If there was perfection in the old covenant, we wouldn't need a new covenant, right? The writer later clarifies this idea of that the old law made nothing perfect in Hebrews later on, well, twice, once in Hebrews 9 and once in Hebrews 10. So in Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 9, we get the writer clarifying that the rituals of the old law did not clear the conscience of the adherence of the old law. So Hebrews 9 and 9, it was symbolic for the present time in which both gifts and sacrifices were offered, which cannot make him who performed the service perfect in regard to conscience. So, now, we didn't ever live under the old law, but had we, our conscience would not have been clean because of the sacrifices and gifts that we had offered. The writer of Hebrews just makes that clear. Your conscience wouldn't have been cleared like it is for us. And then in chapter 10, the first four verses, we sort of get an explanation as to why our conscience wouldn't be clear. And that's because the old law did not remove sin. And again, this is going to be somebody else's topic. I'll just read it, but we won't dive too far into it. For the law, having a shadow of the good things to come and not the very image of the things, can never with the same sacrifices which they offered continually year by year make those who approach perfect. For then they would not have ceased to be offered. For the worshippers, once purified, would have no more consciousness of sin. But in those sacrifices there is a reminder of sins every year. It is not possible that the blood of bulls and goats could take away sins. And so this is how the old law is imperfect, in that the old covenant does not make anything perfect. So does the new law make things perfect? Well, absolutely. And actually, more so than the others, we have lots of scriptural support for this. James chapter 1, verse 25, but he who looks into the what? How's the law called there? The perfect law of liberty, right? And continues in it. It's not a forgetful hearer, but of the doer of the works. This one will be blessed in what he does. The new covenant is called the perfect law of liberty. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 10. And we think of this as the love chapter, right? But this is a section that I think is talking about the new covenant. But that which is perfect has come. That which is in part will be done away. And of course, I think there's more meaning to that too. But this is an example of one place where the new covenant is described as being perfect. We could look at more, but I bet we do that when we look at chapter 10. All right. Any other comments on 18 and 19? Let's look at the last part of the chapter here. Verse 20 and 21. Here we have one additional way in which Jesus' priesthood was different and superior to the Levitical priesthood. And what is that thing that made Jesus' priesthood different than the Levitical priesthood?
The oath.
The oath. Yeah, and verse 20 is confusing in lots of translations because there's a double negative here. 21 helps clean that up for us. But Jesus was made a priest by an oath, and the Levitical priests were not made priests by oath. So how were the Levitical priests chosen?
Well, they were, first of all, they had to be born into the right tribe, and then they had to be certain age, you know, males of certain age, no blemish, had nothing wrong with them. There was a list of things for you to be qualified.
Yeah, so it starts with, you got to be of the tribe of Levi. And if you wanted to be the high priest, was that good enough just to be the tribe of Levi? No, you had to be a descendant of Aaron. And so, you know, there was this, it was restrictive. And then, when those men were ordained as priests or appointed as priests, was an oath given or was an oath taken? And there isn't, at least not that I can find. So, and well, writer of Hebrews tells us that there wasn't. That Christ was ordained as appointed as a high priest through an oath, but the Levitical priests were not. And so why does God appoint Jesus as a high priest with an oath? Why does this matter? Well, certainly when we look at the way the Hebrews is structured, all of this is making this argument that the new covenant, the new law, is better than the old. And so in this case, Christ's priesthood is superior to the Levitical priesthood because of this oath, right? So this is one reason, right? It demonstrates the superiority of Christ's priesthood. And there's a couple of other reasons for that, right? Christ is superior to men. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 28. For the law appoints as high priest men who have weaknesses, but the word of an oath which came after the law appoints the Son who has been perfected forever. So here we have this connection to the oath as well. And the example is that Christ is superior to men because he's perfect and men are weak. Christ's priesthood is also superior because it's eternal. But that's the example that's given in verse 23, right? The Levitical priesthood was temporary it's temporary in two ways. One way is that when the high priest died, what happened? He was replaced. Someone else became high priest. But Jesus was appointed high priest forever. And even the whole system of the Levitical priesthood, it essentially ended after 70 A.D., maybe there are people today who claim to be priests, but their lineage is questionable at best. So the second reason why there is an oath is for our benefit. I want you to consider, for example, why does God speak about Jesus from heaven? A strange, strange shift here, but I think it answers our question for us, right? We often think that God only spoke, well, when did God speak about Jesus from heaven while Jesus was alive?
At his baptism and on the Mount of Transfiguration.
Yeah, and I thought that was it too. And there's a third case, and this third example, which I don't know that we talked too much about because I couldn't remember that it existed, is in John chapter 12. And it's just interesting, the exchange here, because it helps us understand why God spoke about Jesus from heaven. John 12, 27 through 30. "Now my soul is exceedingly troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour." This is Jesus speaking. "But for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name." Then a voice came from heaven saying, "I have both glorified it and will glorify it again." Therefore the people who stood by and heard it said that it had thundered. Others said, "An angel has spoken to him." Jesus answered and said, "This voice did not come because of me, but for your sake." And so this is the reason why God speaks from heaven about Jesus. It's for our benefit. It's for our sake. And so now look at what the Hebrew writer says about the promise given to Abraham. In Hebrews chapter 6, 13 through 18, "For when God made a promise to Abraham, because he could not swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, 'Surely blessings I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply you.' And so, after he patiently endured, he obtained the promise. For men indeed swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is for them at the end of all disputes." Now, notice the next verse. "Thus God determined to show more abundantly to the heir of the promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath, that by two immutable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we must have strong collation who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope set before us." You see, God took an oath to Abraham, and the reason he did that was why? Well, to show to us more abundantly the heirs of promise that God is going to confirm what he does. This is really going to happen. And God takes an oath. And why does he do that? He does it for our benefit. And so in the same way, God appoints Jesus high priest by a benefit for our... God appoints the high priest by an oath for our benefit. So what's the benefit in this oath to us? Well, this is one more way to show to us that the priesthood of Christ is higher, more superior, better than the Levitical priesthood. Because God didn't take an oath for the Levitical priesthood. He didn't ordain them by oath. There was no oath involved. But he did with the priesthood of Christ. Okay, we're going to run through a couple other things here through the chapter. In verse 22, we have it said of Jesus that he has become a surety of a better covenant. Now that's not a word I use very often, surety. What are some other translations say there?
Guarantee.
Now that's a word that I use with some regularity, right? So what does this mean? Jesus has become the guarantee, the surety of a better covenant. Well, I like to think of it like this. When you first agreed, if you've ever done this, when you first agree to buy something significant, like a house, what do you do? You put down earnest money. Yeah, thanks, Mike. I didn't ask that question very good, but your brain was on the same track as mine. Right? You put down earnest money. Well, what does that earnest money do? It guarantees that you're going to get that house, or at least it's supposed to, right? And so Jesus, in some way, is the earnest money that God gave to confirm this new covenant with his people. So what surety did God give to guarantee the old covenant? Jason?
Well, there's a couple of things. There was the covenant of circumcision, but there was also the blood of bulls and goats.
Yeah, but... all right, so I went down that path too, but that's what Abraham did. What did God do? What did God do for the old covenant. And so I had to go back to Genesis, the 15th chapter, when this covenant was given, because that's the exact question Abraham asked. So Genesis chapter 15, verses 1 through 4. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision, saying, "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield and your exceeding great reward." All right, so God here has made a promise to Abraham that he's going to be your shield. I'm going to be your shield and your great reward. Verse 2. But Abram said, "Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless and heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?" Then Abram said, "Look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, no one was born in my house is my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, 'This one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir.'" So Abraham here asks, "What are you going to give me so that I know that your word is good?" Which is a strange thing to ask of God, but that's what Abram asked. What are you going to give me? That's what verse 2 says. And what's God's response? "I'm going to give you a son. I'm going to give you a son." And this makes sense, because what do we call Isaac sometimes?
The son of promise.
The son of promise. Yeah. We call him the son of promise.
It wasn't just that he gave him the son. It's that he was 100 years old when he was born.
Oh, yeah.
That's
oh.
What made the big difference.
Oh, yeah. Most definitely. But the idea that he was given a son. Now I want you to think about what Paul says to the Galatians in Galatians chapter 4, verse 28. "Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are children of promise." This is the idea where we get the idea that Isaac was called the son of promise. So, what is it that God gave as the guarantee of the new covenant? Well, he gave Christ. And it isn't that Christ died, it's that Christ was born, not physically born, but spiritually born, right? Because Christ is the firstborn of the resurrection. And so in that same way, we are brethren, we are going to be born in the resurrection as well. And that way we are children of promise too. So Christ has become a surety of a better covenant. All right, now let's look at verse 25. Verse 25, we're told, "Therefore he is also able to save to the uttermost." Again, another word I don't use very often. Save to the uttermost. What are some of the other translations read there? What does utter, well, or maybe just tell me, what does uttermost mean?
Completely or forever.
Yeah, completely. Completely or forever, right? So you think about this. The salvation offered by the sacrifice of Jesus provided a complete and total forgiveness and removal of sin. And this was very different from the sacrifices of the Levitical priesthood. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 13 and 14, "For the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of heifers sprinkled the unclean sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh. How much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, cleanse your conscience from the dead works to serve the living God?" And then the passage we've already read before, Hebrews chapter 10, verses 1 through 4, where we're told the blood of bulls and goats cannot take away sin. And so Jesus' sacrifice is able to save us completely, whereas the sacrifices of the Old Testament were not able to do that. But notice there's a qualifier on this. What's the qualifier?
You have to come through Christ.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Those who come to God through him. And this is the same condition that is mentioned numerous times through the Bible, right? It's not just that Jesus died and everyone's sins are forgiven because of his death. There's a qualifier there. I mean, yes, the potential exists for everyone's sins to be taken away because of Jesus' sacrifice. His sacrifice isn't limited by the number of people who he can forgive their sins and wash them away. But there's a qualifier, and it's the same qualifier given throughout the New Testament, and that is those who come to God through him. John chapter 10, verse 9. This is one of the I ams that Jesus describes. And Jesus says, I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. And look at what it says after that. If you go in any other way, what are you? You're a thief and a robber, right? There's one door, and that's Jesus. John chapter 14, verse 6. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And then what's the last part of that? Yeah, no one comes to the Father except through me. There is one way to get to God, and it's through Jesus. All right, we'll finish up with the last section, which is 25 through 27. And these are three ways in which Jesus as high priest is better than the high priest of the old covenant. One is that Jesus is a better guarantee, right? He is a guarantee of a better covenant. That's one. The second is that he is able to save to the uttermost. And then the third is really the focus of verse 25 through 27. And that is in verse 26. For such a high priest was fitting for us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners. And it's this last one, separate from sinners, that I think maybe is the most significant of all of that. The third and final example that the writer provides to show how Jesus' superiority, the priesthood is superior to the Levitical priesthood, is this idea that he is separate from sinners. Well, how is he separate from sinners in a way that is different than the high priest of old? Well, the priesthood and the high priest, they were just like Jesus is in some ways, intercessors for the children of Israel, right? So if we lived under the old law, and we needed to make a sacrifice, how did that happen? What did we do? Or we needed to make an offering.
Took it to the priest.
We took it to the priest. Did we sacrifice it ourselves? No.
You gave it, but you didn't sacrifice it.
That's right. You gave it, but you didn't sacrifice it, right? The people would bring their offerings to the temple or to the tabernacle, and the priest would offer it as a sacrifice to God on behalf of the individual. And likewise, what happened on the Day of Atonement? All the people came together, and what did the high priest do? Same thing. He would offer a sacrifice on behalf of the entire nation. But before the high priest could do this, and before the priest could serve and sacrifice on behalf of the people, what did the high priest and the priest have to do? Offer for themselves. And it wasn't just offer for themselves. There was this whole ritual of what had to be done. Exodus chapter 29 goes through some of it, and it's sort of scattered throughout Exodus and then repeated again some in Deuteronomy, right? But before the priest and the high priest could serve as the intercessors for the people, they needed to first cleanse themselves. This is one of the reasons why there was a basin in the temple grounds, because the priests would go and wash themselves. Well, what are they washing? Are they washing the blood off of them from the sacrifices? No, they hadn't even made sacrifices yet. They're washing themselves in a symbolic way to remove their own sin. And so Christ never had to do this and never will have to do this, because he is perfect without sin, and in that way is separate from sinners. He had no need to sacrifice for himself. And that's the point that's being made there in verse 27. Who does not need daily, as those high priests, to offer up sacrifices first for his own sins and then for the people's. For this he did once for all when he offered up himself. See, this is how Christ is a better priest than the Levitical priest, is that he doesn't have to cleanse himself first because he was perfect. So what comments do we have here about this particular section that maybe I haven't covered?
The word once.
Oh yeah, now that's another thing too, yeah. And that's brought out here, right? The priest did this daily, right? It wasn't this, they did it once a year or when they first started to serve. There actually was, Exodus 29 isn't about the daily process that they went through. Exodus 29 is about all of the cleansing that they did when they were ordained as a priest. The mentioning of all of the daily stuff is the stuff that's scattered throughout. But they did it when they were appointed, and then they did it every single day. They had to cleanse themselves. But Christ did it once. But I mean, he didn't even cleanse himself. He sacrificed himself once, whereas the priests were continuously sacrificing. What else? All right, let's take a break, and we'll reconvene in a minute. We'll pick up with chapter 8 next week.